It seems that some humans need to stop defining words like superior, success, and better as being human-like in the first place and take a more objective approach. From a more Darwinian viewpoint, superior could possibly mean more able to survive and procreate. Let's see how humans match up against other life forms, now that we have a more objective form of measurement. The answer. Compared to many other species, humans are losing miserably. Cyanobacteria have been around for several billion years, and had such powerful domination over the Earth that they dramatically transformed its atmosphere. Horseshoe crabs have been around for approximately 445 million years, about 200 million years before dinosaurs. Triops cancriformis has been around for over 220 million years, with no signs of visible change. Even great white sharks are thought to be at least 16 million years old. These are just several types of super successful life forms. In comparison, anatomically modern humans are only about 150 to 200,000 years old. Humans are nowhere close being able to call themselves a successful species. But just because humans have only been around for such a short time does not mean that they will go extinct before outdoing other species, right? Surely humans won't go the way of the dodo. Actually, Dr. David M. Raup has studied past extinction rates and come to the conclusion that the average lifespan of vertebrate species seems to be around 2 to 4 million years. So it looks like humans have about 1.8 to 3.8 million more years to live if everything goes as usual. His findings showed that well-dispersed species were less susceptible to extinction. However, one factor that lowers lifespan is if the species in question is high on the food chain. Perhaps living between 1.8 to 3.8 million more years is the best that the human species can hope for, because it looks like probability is suggesting that humans will go the way of the dodo. Save for one minor detail. The dodo bird, which some humans have jokingly named and relentlessly mocked as being an idiotic, extinct species with little knowledge of survival, has been estimated by some to have lived for several million years or more. That means that if humans live another 1.8 or possibly even 3.8 million years, that might not make us successful enough to go the way of the dodo in terms of survival time. We may actually be around for less time than the dodo bird, one of humanity's most well-known examples of extinction. But wait, there's more. Assuming the human species may live at least 1.8 million more years is only taking typical natural processes into consideration. We have yet to include the fact that we have nuclear weapons.
Let's face it, the threat of hydrogen bomb warfare is the greatest danger our nation has ever known.
Is there any chance that humans would be foolish enough to use them? Actually, there is more than a chance. Shortly after the first nuclear weapons were created, people used nuclear weapons on their own species twice. One of the only differences between then and now is that now nuclear bombs are up to 3,800 times or more powerful, and there are many more of them. Using a nuclear bomb in an act of defense or aggression today would be much different than in the past, since many countries now possess nuclear weapons. The use of a nuclear weapon today could easily escalate into a nuclear war. Even though the US and Soviet Union showed the world that nuclear war was impractical and could lead to mutual assured destruction, some countries around the world are still working very hard to acquire nuclear weapons or perfect the ones they already have. Are the countries trying to acquire and perfect nuclear weapons actually planning on using them? Or are they just willing to spend millions or even billions of dollars for fun? Let's not forget to add in biological weapons and also new, deadlier forms of viruses, created by the experiments of some scientists. It's interesting to think that some humans view themselves as the ultimate life forms, which rule the planet like gods, even though many people have trouble managing their own species and are working very hard to accelerate it towards what looks like a quickly approaching death. So how on earth did the belief that humans are inherently superior to all other life forms emerge? Have humans always thought this way? Do all humans currently think this way? Some earlier hunter-gatherer societies around the world viewed humans as a part of nature, or at least relatively equal to it. Some experts believe that in Australia, Aboriginal people learn from their stories that a society must not be human-centred, but rather land-centred, otherwise they forget their source and purpose. Humans are prone to exploitative behaviour if not constantly reminded they are interconnected with the rest of creation, that they as individuals are only temporal in time, and past and future generations must be included in their perception of their purpose in life. It's not only Australian Aborigines or people living before the years of René Descartes that did not strongly believe in human superiority. Research suggests that Far Eastern, Indian, Greek and many indigenous cultures have higher levels of reverence to other life forms than Abrahamic religions such as Islam, Judaism and Christianity. Plenty of recent Western thinkers also held views in sharp contrast to human superiority, including Darwin, who thought it was absurd to think of some animals as higher than others.
Dr. Stephen Best.
Homo sapiens is an animal that is considered to be radically unique. Now, that's redundant, because by definition, a species is a species that is unique from other species. So to say that human beings are unique, as people like to say, is to say nothing. Of course we're unique. A squirrel is unique, a rat is unique, a dog is unique, by definition. But somehow, we are so unique, we're different from all these other animals. Radically different. And we are unique by defining ourselves in a certain way, and that is as a rational essence. And this has been so well articulated in the Western philosophical tradition from Plato to Aquinas, from Aristotle to Descartes, Kant, and beyond. We still think this is common sense. We are the rational animal. If we say that our essence as humans is rational, and we can identify a certain class of human beings as less than rational, they're less than human. You go through Western history books and reread what the greats had to say, and they will mostly conclude that women were deficient in rationality. Rousseau, for instance, said women have practical rationality but not theoretical rationality. They can't be philosophers. It's nonsense, but this is how the classic figures thought. So if we can say women don't have rationality, we can say they're subhuman and they belong at the bottom of a hierarchy. If we can say people of color, people from Africa, if Europeans can go on colonial missions and say, these aren't rational people, they're animals, they're savages, they're beasts, they're subhuman, then we can put them in the category of animals where they have no value, and we can do anything we want to them. And there is no moral question about it. And every time there's a war, first the enemy has to be reduced to the status of animal. This is part, again, of the politics of human identity. Who gets to be called human, and what are the consequences of that? Notice we are talking about an error, a mistake, an illusion. Because it was Nietzsche who taught us that as soon as human beings begin to think, they immediately make mistakes. They immediately make mistakes in cause and effect and all the different fallacies that you identify in logic class. They immediately think to posit God. They anthropomorphize sun god, moon god. They immediately think somehow they're privileged in the universe. They have irrational fears, etc. Some of these lies are corrected and vanish forever. Some stay with us. The lies that stay with us, the errors that we retain, are the ones, he says, that have utility. They serve our purposes, our pathetic psychological purposes, to be demigods on this earth.
What are humans left with? Are we superior to other life forms in any general, objective sense? From what we learned on this journey, evidence suggests equality between all life forms, that advantages do not come without disadvantages, and that all life is interconnected. Life's unique features such as flight, speed, human-like intelligence and transformation of matter all work together like components of one machine, interdependent and interlocked. As the machine constantly changes and certain components lose their value, they evolve or become extinct. The human component is very new to this machine. Let's see how long it can remain useful.
Well, of course, I agree with Steve Best's implicit suggestion that reason naught, the reason which must never be spoken, is that might makes right. Why must it never be spoken? Well, if we admit that might makes right, then that's an end to so many empty words about morality. I am not willing to believe that morality is a useless concept. I think it's an essential concept. I think the idea of conscience, having an idea of the right thing to do, doing something because it is right, is a very important one. And that's almost a link to the one unique feature about humans, which is that they have a concept of money. I'm almost surprised that wasn't in the film itself as one of the reasons. I don't think it's any claim to virtue, having a system of fictional values which eclipses the right thing to do. One of the most surreal lunch conversations I had for a long time was talking to a friend of mine from university who's now working in the financial high-speed trading department. He's talking about how many extra milliseconds he needs to shave off the algorithms, why they have to be written in one computer programming language rather than another, and how many millions of pounds he could earn as a result. Quite a surreal concept. Almost impossible to reflect on that and in the same brain note the impact of millions of pounds worth of real-world items. The two don't seem to fit easily together to me. So, humans are unique in that they suffer from money psychosis. In the last 10 years I've spent working on this point, one new facet seems to be people's growing awareness that there is nothing natural and plenty of unwholesome features about the modern money system. As we know only too well, there is nothing new in the concept of money and its deleterious effect on human morals. Let's return to our study of their history. This is where we left off in Chapter 8, reading from David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. I had to edit that. Was that a Freudian slip? I just called it Debt, the Last 5,000 Years. Well, I think it might also be that, but that's still slightly too premature, so let's return in Chapter 8. The chapter is entitled Credit versus Bullion and the Cycles of History.
As a starting point to any attempt to discern the great rhythms that define the current historical moment, let me propose the following breakdown of Eurasian history, according to the alternation between periods of virtual and metal money. The cycle begins with the age of the first agrarian empires, 3500 to 800 BC, dominated by virtual credit money. This is followed by the Axial Age, 800 BC to 600 AD, which will be covered in the next chapter, and which saw the rise of coinage and a general shift to metal bullion. The Middle Ages, 600 to 1450 AD, which saw a return to virtual credit money, will be covered in Chapter 10. Chapter 11 will cover the next turn of the cycle, the Age of Capitalist Empires, which began around 1450 with a massive planetary switch back to gold and silver bullion, and which could only really said to have ended in 1971, when Richard Nixon announced that the US dollar would no longer be redeemable in gold. This marked the beginning of yet another phase of virtual money, one which has only just begun, and whose ultimate contours are necessarily invisible. Chapter 12, the final chapter, will be devoted to applying the insights of history to understanding what it might mean and the opportunities it might throw open. Mesopotamia, 3500 to 800 BC. We've already had occasion to note the predominance of credit money in Mesopotamia, the earliest urban civilization that we know about. In the great temple and palace complexes, not only did money serve largely as an accounting measure rather than physically changing hands, merchants and tradespeople developed credit arrangements of their own. Most of these took the physical form of clay tablets, inscribed with some obligation of future payment, and were then sealed inside clay envelopes marked with the borrower's seal. The creditor would keep the envelope as a surety, and it would be broken open upon repayment. In some times or places at least, these bullae appear to have become what we would now call negotiable instruments, since the tablet inside did not simply record a promise to pay the original lender, but was designated to the bearer. In other words, a tablet recording a debt of 5 shekels of silver, at prevailing rates of interest, could circulate as the equivalent of a 5-shekel promissory note, that is, as money. We don't know how often this happened, how many hands such transactions would typically pass through, how many transactions were based on credit, how often merchants actually did weigh out silver in rough chunks to buy and sell their merchandise, or when they were most likely to do so. No doubt, all this varied over time. Promissory notes usually circulated within merchant guilds, or between inhabitants of relatively well-off urban neighbourhoods where people knew one another well enough to trust them to be accountable, but not so well that they could rely on one another for more traditional forms of mutual aid. We know even less about the marketplaces frequented by ordinary Mesopotamians, except that tavern keepers operated on credit, and hawkers and operators of market stalls probably did as well. The origins of interest will forever remain obscure, since they preceded the invention of writing. The terminology for interest in most ancient languages is derived from some word for offspring, causing some to speculate that it originates in loans of livestock, but this seems a bit literal-minded. More likely, the first widespread interest-bearing loans were commercial. Temples and palaces would forward wares to merchants and commercial agents, who would then trade them in nearby mountain kingdoms or on trading expeditions overseas. The practice is significant because it implies a fundamental lack of trust. After all, why not simply demand a share in the profits? This seems more fair. A merchant who came back bankrupt would probably have little means of paying anyway, and profit-sharing partnerships of this sort became common practice in the later Middle East. The answer seems to be that profit-sharing partnerships were typically contracted between merchants or anyway people of similar background and experience who had ways of keeping track of one another. Palace or temple bureaucracies and world-roaming merchant adventurers had little in common, and the bureaucrats seemed to have concluded that one could not normally expect a merchant returned from a far-off land to be entirely honest about his adventures. A fixed interest rate would render irrelevant whatever elaborate tales of robbery, shipwreck, or attacks by winged snakes or elephants a creative merchant might have concocted. The return was fixed in advance. This connection between borrowing and lying, incidentally, is an important one to history. Herodotus remarked about the Persians, "To tell a lie is considered by them the greatest disgrace, and next to that, to be in debt, especially because they think the one in debt must of necessity tell lies." Later, Herodotus reported a story told to him by a Persian about the origins of the gold that the Persians had acquired in India. They stole it from the nests of giant ants. Jesus's parable about the unforgiving servant makes a joke out of the matter. 10,000 talents, no problem, just give me a little more time. But even here, one can see how such endless falsehoods contributed to a broader sense that a world in which moral relations were conceived as debts is also, while in certain ways entertaining, necessarily a world of corruption, guilt, and sin. By the time of the earliest Sumerian documents, this world may not yet have arrived. Still, the principle of lending at interest, even compound interest, was already familiar to everyone. In 2402 BC, for instance, a royal inscription by King Enmetana of Lagash, one of the earliest we have, complains that his enemy, the king of Ummah, had been occupying a huge stretch of farmland that had rightfully belonged to Lagash for decades. He announces, if one were to calculate the rental fees for all that land, then the interest that would have been due on that rent compounded annually, it would reveal that Ummah now owes Lagash 4.5 trillion litres of barley. The sum was, as in the parable, intentionally preposterous. It was just an excuse to start a war. Still, he wanted everyone to know that he knew exactly how to do the math. Usury, in the sense of interest-bearing consumer loans, was also well established in Enmetanar's time. The king ultimately had his war and won it, and 2 years later, fresh off his victory, he was forced to publish another edict, this one a general debt cancellation within his kingdom. As he later boasted, quote, he instituted freedom, amargi, in Lagash. He restored the child to its mother, and the mother to her child. He cancelled all interest due, unquote. This was, in fact, the very first such declaration we have on record, and the first time in history that the word freedom appears in a political document. Enmetanar's text is a bit vague on the details, but a half century later, when his successor, Uruinimgina, declared a general amnesty during the New Year's celebrations of 2350 BC, the terms are all spelled out, and they conform to what was to become typical of such amnesties, cancelling not only all outstanding loans, but all forms of debt servitude, even those based on failure to pay fees or criminal penalties, the only thing accepted being commercial loans. Similar declarations are to be found again and again in Sumerian and later Babylonian and Assyrian records, and always with the same theme: the restoration of justice and equity, the protection of widows and orphans to ensure, as Hammurabi was to put it when he abolished debts in Babylon in 1761 BC, that the strong might not oppress the weak. In the words of Michael Hudson, quote, the designated occasion for clearing Babylonia's financial slate was the New Year festival, celebrated in the spring. Babylonian rulers oversaw the ritual of breaking the tablets, that is, the debt records, restoring economic balance as part of the calendrical renewal of society along with the rest of nature. Hammurabi and his fellow rulers signalled these proclamations by raising a torch, probably symbolizing the sun god of justice, Shamash, whose principles were supposed to guide wise and fair rulers. Persons held as debt pledges were released to rejoin their families. Other debtors were restored cultivation rights to their customary lands, free of whatever mortgage liens had been accumulated. Unquote. Over the next several thousand years, this same list, cancelling the debts, destroying the records, reallocating the land, was to become the standard list of demands of peasant revolutionaries everywhere. In Mesopotamia, rulers appear to have headed off the possibility of unrest by instituting such reforms themselves, as a grand gesture of cosmic renewal, the recreation of the social universe. In Babylonia, during the same ceremony in which the king reenacts his god Marduk's creation of the physical universe, the history of debt and sin was wiped out, and it was time to begin again. But it's also clear what they saw as the alternative. The world plunged into chaos, with farmers defecting to swell the ranks of nomadic pastoralists, and ultimately, if the breakdown continued, returning to overrun the cities and destroy the existing economic order entirely. Egypt, 2650 to 716 BC. Egypt represents an interesting contrast, since for most of its history, it managed to avoid the development of interest-bearing debt entirely. Egypt was, like Mesopotamia, extraordinarily rich by ancient standards, but it was also a self-contained society, a river running through a desert, and far more centralized than Mesopotamia. The pharaoh was a god, and the state and temple bureaucracies had their hands in everything. There were a dazzling array of taxes and a continual distribution of allotments, wages, and payments from the state. Here too, money clearly arose as a means of account. The basic unit was the deben, or measure, originally referring to measures of grain, and later of copper or silver. Few records make clear the catch-as-catch-can nature of most transactions. Quote, in the 15th year of Ramesses II, that's around 1275 BC, a merchant offered the Egyptian lady Irenophra a Syrian slave girl whose price, no doubt after bargaining, was fixed at 4 deben, 1 kite, about 373 grams, of silver. Erenofre made up a collection of clothes and blankets to the value of 2 deben and 2 1/3 kite. The details are set out in the record, and then borrowed a miscellany of objects from her neighbours, bronze vessels, a pot of honey, 10 shirts, 10 deben of copper ingots, till the price was made up. Unquote. Most merchants were itinerant, either foreigners or commercial agents for the owners of large estates. There's not much evidence for commercial credit, however. Loans in Egypt were still more likely to take the form of mutual aid between neighbours. Substantial, legally enforceable loans, the kind that can lead to the loss of lands or family members, are documented, but they appear to have been rare, much less pernicious, as the loans did not bear interest. Similarly, we do occasionally hear of debt bond servants and even debt slaves, but these seem to have been unusual phenomena, and there's no suggestion that matters ever reached crisis proportions as they so regularly did in Mesopotamia and the Levant. In fact, for the first several thousand years, we seem to be in a somewhat different world, where debt really was a matter of guilt and treated largely as a criminal matter. Quote, when a debtor failed to repay his debt on time, his creditor could take him to court, where the debtor would be required to promise to pay in full by a specific date. As part of his promise, which was under oath, the debtor also pledged to undergo 100 blows and or repay twice the amount of the original loan if he failed to pay by the date specified. Unquote. The and or is significant. There was no formal distinction between a fine and a beating. In fact, the entire purpose of the oath, rather like the Cretan custom of having a borrower pretend to snatch the money, seems to have been to create the justification for punitive action, so the debtor could be punished as either a perjurer or a thief. By the time of the New Kingdom, 1550 to 1070, there is more evidence for markets, but it's only by the time we reach the Iron Age, just before Egypt was absorbed into the Persian Empire, that we begin to see evidence for Mesopotamian-style debt crises. Greek sources, for instance, record that the pharaoh Bakenranef, who reigned 720 to 715 BC, issued a decree abolishing debt bondage and annulling all outstanding liabilities, since, quote, he felt it would be absurd for a soldier, perhaps at the moment when he was setting forth to fight for his fatherland, to be hauled off to prison by his creditor for an unpaid loan, unquote. Which, if true, is also one of the earliest mentions of a debt prison. Under the Ptolemies, the Greek dynasty that ruled Egypt after Alexander, periodic clean slates had become institutionalized. It's well known that the Rosetta Stone, written both in Greek and Egyptian, proved to be the key that made it possible to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics. Few are aware of what it actually says. The stela was originally raised to announce an amnesty, both for debtors and for prisoners, declared by Ptolemy V in 196 BC. China, 2200 to 771 BC. We can say almost nothing about Bronze Age India, since its writing remains indecipherable, and not much more about early China. What little we do know, mainly culled from dribs and drabs in later literary sources, suggests that the earliest Chinese states were far less bureaucratic than their Western cousins. There being no centralized temple or palace system with priests and administrators managing the storerooms and recording inputs and outputs, there was little incentive to create a single, uniform unit of account. Instead, the evidence suggests a different path, with social currencies of various sorts still holding sway in the countryside and being converted to commercial purposes in dealings between strangers. Later sources recall that early rulers used pearls and jade as their superior method of payment, gold as their middle method of payment, and knives and spades as their lower method of payment. The author can only be talking about gifts here, and hierarchical ones at that. Kings and great magnates rewarding their followers for services, in theory, rendered voluntarily. In most places, long strings of cowrie shells figure prominently. But even here, though we often hear of the cowrie money of early China, and it's easy enough to find texts in which the value of sumptuous gifts are measured in cowries, it's never clear whether people were really carrying them around to buy and sell things in the marketplace. The most likely interpretation is that they were carrying the shells, but for a long time marketplaces themselves were of minor significance, so this use was not nearly as important as the usual uses for social currencies, marriage presents, fines, fees, and tokens of honour. At any rate, all sources insist that there was a wide variety of currencies in circulation. As David Scheidel, one of the premier contemporary scholars of early money, notes, quote, "In pre-imperial China, money took the form of cowrie shells, both originals and, increasingly, bronze imitations, tortoise shells, weighed gold, and, rarely, silver bars, and most notably, from at least 1000 BC onward, utensil money in the shape of spade blades and knives made of bronze." Unquote. These were most often used between people who didn't know each other very well, for tabulating debts between neighbours, with local vendors, or with anything having to do with government. People appeared to have employed a variety of credit instruments. Later Chinese historians claimed that the earliest of these were knotted strings, rather like the Inca quipu system, and then later notched strips of wood or bamboo. As in Mesopotamia, these appear to have long predated writing. We don't really know when the practice of lending at interest first reached China either, or whether Bronze Age China came to see the same sorts of debt crises as occurred in Mesopotamia. But there are tantalizing hints in later documents. For instance, later Chinese legends about the origin of coinage ascribe the invention to emperors trying to relieve the effects of natural disasters. One early Han text reports, quote, "In ancient times, during the floods of Yu and the droughts of Tang, the common people became so exhausted that they were forced to borrow from one another in order to obtain food and clothing. Emperor Yu coined money for his people from the gold of Mount Li, and Emperor Tang did likewise from the copper of Mount Yan. Therefore, the world called them benevolent." Unquote. Other versions are a little more explicit. The Guanzi, a collection that in early imperial China became the standard primer on political economy, notes, "There were people who lacked even gruel to eat, and who were forced to sell their children. To rescue these people, Tang coined money." The story is clearly fanciful. The real origins of coined money were at least 1,000 years later, and it's very hard to know what to make of it. Could this reflect a memory of children being taken away as debt sureties? On the face of it, it seems more like starving people selling their children outright, a practice that was later to become commonplace in certain periods of Chinese history. But the juxtaposition of loans and the sale of children is suggestive, especially considering what was happening on the other side of Asia at exactly the same time. The Guanzi later goes on to explain that these same rulers instituted the custom of retaining 30% of the harvest in public granaries for redistribution in emergencies, so as to ensure that this would never happen again. In other words, they began to set up just the kind of bureaucratic storage facilities that, in places like Egypt and Mesopotamia, had been responsible for creating money as a unit of account to begin with.
Chapter 9. The Axial Age, 800 BC to 600 AD. The chapter begins with a quote from Carl Jaspers' The Way to Wisdom. Quote, "Let's designate this period as the Axial Age. Extraordinary events are crowded into this period. In China lived Confucius and Lao Tse. All the trends in Chinese philosophy arose. In India, it was the age of the Upanishads and of Buddha. As in China, all philosophical trends, including skepticism and materialism, sophistry and nihilism, were developed." Unquote. The phrase "the Axial Age" was coined by the German existentialist philosopher Karl Jaspers. In the course of writing a history of philosophy, Jaspers became fascinated by the fact that figures like Pythagoras, 570 to 495 BC, the Buddha, 563 to 483 BC, and Confucius, 551 to 479 BC, were all alive at exactly the same time, and that Greece, India, and China, in that period, all saw a sudden efflorescence of debate between contending individual schools, each group apparently unaware of the other's existence. Like the simultaneous invention of coinage, why this happened had always been a puzzle. Jaspers wasn't entirely sure himself. To some extent, he suggested, it must have been an effect of similar historical conditions. For most of the great urban civilizations of the time, the early Iron Age was a kind of pause between empires. a time when political landscapes were broken into a checkerboard of often diminutive kingdoms and city-states, most often at constant war externally and locked in constant political debate within. Each case witnessed the development of something akin to a dropout culture, with ascetics and sages fleeing to the wilderness or wandering from town to town seeking wisdom. In each, too, they were eventually reabsorbed into the political order as a new kind of intellectual or spiritual elite, whether as Greek sophists, Jewish prophets, Chinese sages, or Indian holy men. Whatever the reasons, the result, Jaspers argued, was the first period in history in which human beings applied principles of reasoned inquiry to the great questions of human existence. He observed that all of these great regions of the world, China, India, and the Mediterranean, saw the emergence of remarkably parallel philosophical trends, from skepticism to idealism. In fact, almost the entire range of positions about the nature of the cosmos, mind, action, and the ends of human existence that have remained the stuff of philosophy to this day. As one of Jaspers' disciples later put it, overstating only slightly, quote, "No really new ideas have been added since that time." Unquote. For Jaspers, the period begins with the Persian prophet Zoroaster about 800 BC and ends about 200 BC, to be followed by a spiritual age that centres on figures like Jesus and Muhammad. For my own purposes, I find it more useful to combine the two. Let us define the Axial Age, then, as running from 800 BC to 600 AD. This makes the Axial Age the period that saw the birth not only of all the world's major philosophical tendencies, but also all of today's major world religions, Zoroastrianism, Prophetic Judaism, Buddhism, Jainism, Hinduism, Confucianism, Taoism, Christianity, and Islam. The attentive reader may have noticed that the core period of Jaspers' Axial Age, the lifetimes of Pythagoras, Confucius, and the Buddha, corresponds almost exactly to the period in which coinage was invented. What's more, the three parts of the world where coins were first invented were also the very parts of the world where those sages lived. In fact, they became the epicenters of Axial Age religious and philosophical creativity. The kingdoms and city-states around the Yellow River in China, the Ganges Valley in northern India, and the shores of the Aegean Sea. What was the connection? You might start by asking, what is a coin? The normal definition is that a coin is a piece of valuable metal shaped into a standardized unit, with some emblem or mark inscribed to authenticate it. The world's first coins appear to have been created within the kingdom of Lydia, in western Anatolia, now Turkey, sometime around 600 BC. These first Lydian coins were basically just round lumps of electrum, a gold-silver alloy that occurred naturally in the nearby Pactolus River that had been heated and then hammered with some kind of insignia. The very first, stamped with only a few letters, appear to have been manufactured by ordinary jewellers, but these disappeared almost instantly, replaced by coins manufactured in a newly established royal mint. Greek cities on the Anatolian coast soon began to strike their own coins. They came to be adopted in Greece itself. The same thing occurred in the Persian Empire after it absorbed Lydia in 547 BC. In both India and China, we can observe the same pattern. Invented by private citizens, coinage was quickly monopolized by the state. The first Indian money, which seems to have appeared at some point in the 6th century, consisted of bars of silver trimmed down to uniform weights, then punch-marked with some kind of official symbol. Most of the examples discovered by archaeologists contain numerous additional counterpunches, presumably added much in the way that a check or other credit instrument is endorsed before being transferred. Now, this strongly suggests that they were being handled by people used to dealing with more abstract credit instruments. Much early Chinese coinage also shows signs of having evolved directly from social currencies. Some were in fact cast bronze in the shape of cowries, although others took the shape of diminutive knives, discs, or spades. In every case, local governments quickly stepped in, presumably within the space of about a generation. However, since in each of the three areas there was a plethora of tiny states, This meant that each ended up with a wide variety of different currency systems. For example, around 700 BC, northern India was still divided into Janapadas, or tribal territories, some of them monarchies and some republics, and in the 6th century there were still at least 16 major kingdoms. In China, this was the period where the old Zhao Empire first devolved into vying principalities. The spring and autumn period, 722 to 481 BC, then splintered into the chaos of the warring states, 475 to 221 BC. Like the Greek city-states, all of the resulting kingdoms, no matter how diminutive, aspired to issue their own official currency. Recent scholarship has shed a great deal of light on how this must have happened. Gold, silver, and bronze, the materials from which the coins were made, had long been the media of international trade, but until that time only the rich had actually had much in their possession. A typical Sumerian farmer may well have never had occasion to hold a substantial piece of silver in his hand, except perhaps at his wedding. Most precious metals took the form of wealthy women's anklets and heirloom chalices, presented by kings to their retainers, or it was simply stockpiled in temples, in ingot form as sureties for loans. Somehow, during the Axial Age, all this began to change. Large amounts of silver, gold, and copper were de-thesaurized, as the economic historians like to say. It was removed from the temples and houses of the rich, and placed in the hands of ordinary people, was broken into tinier pieces, and began to be used in everyday transactions. How? Israeli classicist David Shapps provides the most plausible suggestion. Most of it was stolen. This was a period of generalized warfare, and it is in the nature of war that precious things are plundered. Quote, "Soldiers who plunder may indeed go first for the women, the alcoholic drinks, or the food, but they will also be looking around for things of value that are easily portable. A long-term standing army will tend to accumulate many things that are valuable and portable, and the most valuable and portable items are precious metals and precious stones. It may well have been the protracted wars among the states of these areas that first produced a large population of people with precious metal in their possession and a need for everyday necessities. Where there are people who want to buy, there will be people willing to sell, as innumerable tracts on black markets, drug dealing, and prostitution point out. The constant warfare of the archaic age of Greece, the Janapadas of India, and the warring states of China was a powerful impetus for the development of market trade, and in particular for market trade based on the exchange of precious metal, usually in small amounts. If plunder brought precious metal into the hands of the soldiers, the market will have spread it through the population." Unquote. Now, one might object, but surely war and plunder were nothing new. The Homeric epics, for instance, show a well-nigh obsessive interest in the division of the spoils. True, but what the Axial Age also saw, again, equally in China, India, and the Aegean, was the rise of a new kind of army, made up not of aristocratic warriors and their retainers, but trained professionals. The period when the Greeks began to use coinage, for instance, was also the period when they developed their famous phalanx tactics, which required constant drill and training of the hoplite soldiers. The results were so extraordinarily effective that the Greek mercenaries were soon being sought after from Egypt to Crimea. But unlike the Homeric retainers, who could simply be ignored, an army of trained mercenaries needs to be rewarded in some meaningful way. One could perhaps provide them all with livestock, but livestock are hard to transport, or with promissory notes, but these would be worthless in the mercenary's own country. Allowing each a tiny share of the plunder does seem an obvious solution. These new armies were, directly or indirectly, under the control of governments, and it took governments to turn these chunks of metal into genuine currency. The main reason for this is simply scale. To create enough coins that the people could begin to use them in everyday transactions required mass production on a scale far beyond the abilities of local merchants or smiths. Of course, we've already seen why governments might have incentive to do so. The existence of markets was highly convenient for governments and not just because it made it so much easier for them to provision large standing armies, by insisting that only their coins were acceptable as fees, fines, or taxes, governments were able to overwhelm the innumerable social currencies that already existed in their hinterlands and to establish something like uniform national markets. Actually, one theory is that the very first Lydian coins were invented explicitly to pay mercenaries. This might help explain why the Greeks, who supplied most of the mercenaries, so quickly became accustomed to the use of coins, and why the use of coinage spread so quickly across the Hellenic world, so that by 480 BC, there were at least 100 mints operating in different Greek cities, even though at that time, none of the great trading nations of the Mediterranean had as yet showed the slightest interest in them. The Phoenicians, for example, were considered the greatest merchants and bankers of antiquity. They were also great inventors, having been the first to develop both the alphabet and the abacus. Yet, for centuries after the invention of coinage, they preferred to continue conducting business as they always had, with unwrought ingots and promissory notes. Phoenician cities struck no coins until 365 BC, and while Carthage, the great Phoenician colony in North Africa that came to dominate commerce in the Western Mediterranean, did so a bit earlier, it was only when, quote, forced to do so to pay Sicilian mercenaries, and its issues were marked in Punic, for the people of the camp, unquote. On the other hand, in the extraordinary violence of the Axial Age, being a great trading nation, rather than, say, an aggressive military power, like Persia, Athens, or Rome, was not ultimately a winning proposition. The fate of the Phoenician cities is instructive. Sidon, the wealthiest, was destroyed by the Persian emperor Artaxerxes III after a revolt in 351 BC. 40,000 of its inhabitants are said to have committed mass suicide rather than surrender. 19 years later, Tyre was destroyed after a prolonged siege by Alexander. 10,000 died in battle, and the 30,000 survivors were sold into slavery. Carthage lasted longer, but when Roman armies finally destroyed the city in 146 BC, hundreds of thousands of Carthaginians were said to have been raped and slaughtered, and 50,000 captives put on the auction block, after which the city itself was razed and its fields sowed with salt. All this may bring home something of the level of violence amidst which Axial Age thought developed, but it also leaves us asking, what exactly was the ongoing relation among coinage, military power, and this unprecedented outpouring of ideas? The Mediterranean. Here again, our best information is from the Mediterranean world, and I have already provided some of its outlines. Comparing Athens with its far-flung naval empire and Rome, we can immediately detect striking similarities. In each city, history begins with a series of debt crises. In Athens, the first crisis, the one that culminated in Solon's reforms of 594 BC, was so early that coinage could hardly have been a factor. In Rome, too, the earliest crises seem to have preceded the advent of currency. Rather, in each case, coinage became a solution. In brief, one might say that these conflicts over debt had two possible outcomes. The first was that the aristocrats could win, and the poor remain slaves of the rich, which in practice meant that most people would end up clients of some wealthy patron. Such states were generally militarily ineffective. The second was that popular factions could prevail, institute the usual popular program of redistribution of lands and safeguards against debt peonage, thus creating the basis for a class of free farmers whose children would, in turn, be free to spend much of their time training for war. Coinage played a critical role in maintaining this kind of free peasantry, secure in their landholding, not tied to any great lord, by bounds of debt. In fact, the fiscal policies of many Greek cities amounted to little more than elaborate systems for the distribution of loot. It's important to emphasize that few ancient cities, if any, went so far as to outlaw predatory lending or even debt peonage entirely. Instead, they threw money at the problem. Gold, and especially silver, were acquired in war or mined by slaves captured in war. Mints were located in temples, the traditional place for depositing spoils, and city-states developed endless ways to distribute coins, not only to soldiers, sailors, and those producing arms or outfitting ships, but to the populace generally, as jury fees, fees for attending public assemblies, or sometimes just as outright distributions, as Athens did most famously when they discovered a new vein of silver in the mines at Laurium in 483 BC. At the same time, insisting that the same coins served as legal tender for all payments due to the state guaranteed that they would be in sufficient demand, that markets would soon develop. Many of the political crises in ancient Greek cities similarly turned on the distribution of the spoils. Here is another incident recorded in Aristotle, who provides a conservative take on the origins of a coup in the city of Rhodes around 391 BC. Now, demagogues here refers to the leaders of the democracy. Quote, "The demagogues needed money to pay the people for attending the assembly and serving on juries, for if the people did not attend, the demagogues would lose their influence. They raised at least some of the money they needed by preventing the disbursement of the money due to the trireme commanders, that's warship commanders, under their contracts with the city to build and fit triremes for the Rhodian navy. Since the trireme commanders were not paid, they were unable in turn to pay their suppliers and workers, who sued the trireme commanders. To escape these lawsuits, the trireme commanders banded together and overthrew the democracy." Unquote. It was slavery, though, that made all this possible. As the figures concerning Sidon, Tyre, and Carthage suggest, enormous numbers of people were being enslaved in many of these conflicts, and, of course, many slaves ended up working in the mines, producing even more gold, silver, and copper. The mines in Laurium reportedly employed 10,000 to 20,000 of them. Geoffrey Ingham calls the resulting system a military coinage complex, although I think it would be more accurate to call it a military coinage slavery complex. Anyway, that describes rather nicely how it worked in practice. When Alexander set out to conquer the Persian Empire, he borrowed much of the money with which to pay and provision his troops, and he minted his first coins, used to pay his creditors and continue to support the money, by melting down gold and silver plundered after his initial victories. However, an expeditionary force needed to be paid, and paid well. Alexander's army, which numbered some 120,000 men, required half a ton of silver a day just for wages. For this reason, conquest meant that the existing Persian system of mines and mints had to be reorganized around providing for the invading army. And ancient mines, of course, were worked by slaves. In turn, most slaves in mines were war captives. Presumably most of the unfortunate survivors of the Siege of Tyre ended up working in such mines. One can see how this process might feed upon itself. Alexander was also the man responsible for destroying what remained of the ancient credit systems, since not only the Phoenicians, but also the old Mesopotamian heartland, had resisted the new coin economy. His armies not only destroyed Tyre, they also dethesaurized the gold and silver reserves of Babylonian and Persian temples, the security on which their credit systems were based, and insisted that all taxes to his new government be paid in his own money. The result was to, quote, "release the accumulated specie of century onto the market in a matter of months," unquote. Something like 180,000 talents, or in contemporary terms, an estimated $285 billion. The Hellenistic successor kingdoms established by Alexander's generals from Greece to India employed mercenaries rather than national armies. But the story of Rome is, again, similar to that of Athens. Its early history, as recorded by official chroniclers like Livy, is one of the continual struggles between patricians and plebeians, and of continued crises over debt. Periodically, these would lead to what were called moments of the secession of the plebs, when the commoners of the city abandoned their fields and workshops, camped outside the city, and threatened mass defection, an interesting halfway point between the popular revolts of Greece and the strategy of exodus typically pursued in Egypt and Mesopotamia. Here too, the patricians were ultimately faced with a decision. They could use agricultural loans to gradually turn the plebeian population into a class of bonded labourers on their estates, or they could accede to popular demands for debt protection, preserve a free peasantry, and employ the younger sons of free farm families as soldiers. As the prolonged history of crises, secessions, and reforms makes clear, the choice was made grudgingly. The plebs practically had to force the senatorial class to take the imperial option. Still, they did, and over time, they gradually presided over the establishment of a welfare system that recycled at least a share of the spoils to soldiers, veterans, and their families. It seems significant in this light that the traditional date of the first Roman coinage, 338 BC, is almost exactly the date when debt bondage was finally outlawed, 326 BC. Again, coinage, minted from war spoils, didn't cause the crisis. It was used as a solution. In fact, the entire Roman Empire, at its height, could be understood as a vast machine for the extraction of precious metals and their coining and distribution to the military, combined with taxation policies designed to encourage conquered populations to adopt coins in their everyday transactions. Even so, for most of its history, use of coins was heavily concentrated in two regions, in Italy and a few major cities, and on the frontiers where the legions were actually stationed. In areas where there were neither mines nor military operations, older credit systems presumably continued to operate. I will add one final note here. In Greece, as in Rome, attempts to solve the debt crisis through military expansion were always, ultimately, just ways of fending off the problem, and they only worked for a limited period of time.
And that, all too relevant for the present day point, I'm afraid, is where we're going to have to leave David Graeber this week due to time. I hope we're going to have time to pick up in Chapter 9 next week when we return for more on flight from meaning, how reasoning and thinking has come to eclipse feeling, how the universal love of life has been eclipsed in many people, how they no longer follow their heart, but their head. To catch me and hang me, my shiny black bit. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for thoughts about future episodes and discussion of where the show is going. If you have comments on this episode, you can leave them at this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/606. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I appreciate your feedback. I hope you found this episode confronting and helpful as regards finding meaning in your life. Brave man, they'll take your money.